The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
Now we ask the question, why do you have that kind of syntax? The reason is very obvious. It is characteristic of Paul's style to throw in parentheses. So here, after verse 12, you have a parenthesis. And that parenthesis continues until verse 17. And the reason is that the datum expressed or intimated in the last clause of verse 12 required the apostle that the apostle explain that particular clause, the in that all sin. Now it is highly probable that this parenthesis extending from verse 17 to verse 13 through 17 is not one parenthesis but a double parenthesis. And that verses 13 and 14 are directly related to the last clause in verse 12. And verses 15 to 17 directly related to the last clause in verse 14. In the last clause of verse 14, you have a typological datum. Typological datum. Namely, that Adam is the type of the one to come. And having stated that typological datum, the apostle was required to develop its implications. Develop the similarities, but also the contrasts involved in the fact that Adam is the type of Christ. In verse 12, the Apostle Paul began with the prothesis of a certain comparison. He did not at that point provide the apothesis, because a parenthesis was necessary in order to expand some of the implications of the protists. In this passage, he does not supply us with the apodosis of verse 12 in the precise terms the protists would have required. But at verse 18, he returns to the type of construction which he began in verse 12. He returns to that type of construction and provides us with a finished comparison. That is, a comparison with both protists and apodosis. And that same type of comparison is continued, and that same type of comparison with the same kind of construction is continued in verse 19. So in verses 18 and 19 you have this completed comparison. And at the middle of each verse you have kutos kai. Kutos kai. Junction, that type of construction that would close comparison. Hence, on the basis of verses 18 and 19, we can conclusively determine what the apodosis of verse 12 would have been had not interrupted the sequence of his thought by inserting this parenthesis, or preferably these parentheses. It would be premature at this particular point to say what that apodosis would have been if it had been supplied in the exact terms of the protists. But nevertheless, as we shall discover later on, it was very easy to supply what the apodosis, and it would begin with Kutos Kai. As so and so is so evil, so something else. Now, at first blush, this parenthesis of verses 13 through 17 seems very perplexing to us. Seems very awkward. After all, when we examine the whole passage, is this parenthesis is most significant and eloquent for the interpretation of what on all accounts is the pivotal clause in this whole passage, at least as far as our present interest is concerned. The pivotal clause in this whole passage is the last clause in verse 12, echo panthes amartam. And if we do not rightly understand the reference in that clause, all doctrine of the apostle in this passage is missed. And not only do we fail to understand the relation of Adam to the race, we also fail to understand the relation of Christ to his redeemed. That is the syntax. Now we come to the second main subdivision of study. And this is concerned with the sin contemplated. That's simply a title. The sin contemplated. And this has particular reference to the last clause in verse 12, F.O. Panthes Hemarton, in that all sin, in that all sin, F.O. Is that? Conjunctival expression. It's not a relative expression. Paul doesn't say en ho panthes hemarton, in whom all sin, which he could very well have used if that were his precise thought, but there. O Panthes Hemarton. And F.O. has the force of a conjunction and means in that. You would expand it, it would be epi two to hoti upon this that. Epi two to hoti. That expansion would mean on the ground of the fact that, on the ground of the fact that, the abridged expression F.O. simply means in that, and has the force of our conjunction because. Now there is no need to try to demonstrate that significance of F.O. because there is practically unanimous agreement among exegetes at the present time, for a long time also, to that effect. It is perfectly true, as a matter of Paul's teaching, that all sinned in Adam. All sinned in Adam. And consequently the clause in whom all sinned is of itself correct. But that is not the precise thought of the apostle here. Deliberately use this causal conjunction. Causal conjunction. Because it gives the reason. Gives the reason why death penetrated to to all men. Later on in this passage, he will make clear that it is the reason also why condemnation passed upon all men, and also why it can be said that all sinned in the sin of Adam. Now, what is meant by it? In that all sinned, or because that all sinned, or on the ground of the fact that all sinned. So what does this Panthers, he mark on, refer? Well, there's no exegetical question in this passage that is more important. This is the pivotal question. Not only exegetically, but from the standpoint of historical theology. And when I say historical theology, I bring it right up to date. Because the burning question in present-day theology, because of the dialectic influence, the burning question in present-day theology is, what did Paul mean when he said, "Passers be marked"? Now, that form, as a matter of form, could very well refer to the actual sins of all men. And if Paul meant the actual sins of all men, there is no other expression that would have been more suitable. I say if he actually meant the actual sins of all men, no other expression would have been more suitable to express that thought than Panthes Haemarton. But the question is not to be determined by grammatical possibility, but by contextual consideration. So we have to deal with the various views that have been propounded respecting this particular clause, F.O. Panthes Haemarton. And you first of all have, and a big one, you have the Pelagian view. Now that was the view propounded by Pelagius himself. And his view was that this refers to the actual sins of all men. The actual sins of all men. And so the verse means on that supposition that as Adam sinned and therefore died, so in like manner, all men sin and they likewise die. Perfect parallel between Adam and all men. And Adam is simply the prototype. After whose pattern all other men die. They follow his example, and therefore they die. Now, this is not 4th century or 5th century doctrine. It was a 5th century doctrine, but regrettably it's not confined to 4th century or 5th century theory. The current exegesis of this clause is after the Pelagian pattern. Now, it never entered into Pelagia's mind. Never entered into Pelagia's mind that Genesis 2 and 3 were mythical, or that they were legendary. He believed in the historical Adam according to the Genesis account. But today, in the dialectic way of thinking, on the assumption that Genesis 3 is just mythical, Genesis 2 and 3 are mythical or legendary, Adam is regarded simply as the typical man. Adam may never have existed, you see. He may never have existed, as Genesis 2 and 3 describe. But Adam is every man. He's all of us. We are all Adam. And Adam, in that sense, is simply a typical, simply the typical man. And on that basis, Romans 5:12b is what is interpreted as referring to the sins that all men commit. And although the dialectic theology rests on an entirely different biblico-theological basis, or an entirely different biblico-theological perspective, nevertheless, exegetically, it belongs to the category of the Pelagian exegesis. For we are all Adam, and that is what is expressed in death, hope, happiness, hatred, all sin. So you see, we are dealing not with this from the standpoint of historical theology, but we are also dealing with from the standpoint of a crucial interest at the present time. Well, now, the Pelagian exegesis is that therefore Pantes Hemarton refers to the sins of all men. Is that view tenable? Now, it has sometimes been thought, and I find my students again and again falling into that error. The syntax of verse 12 cannot be pleaded as a refutation of the Pelagian view. Cannot be pleaded as a refutation of the Pelagian view. Pelagius himself is fully aware of the construction of verse of Romans 5:12. And the Latin text with which he was dealing. The Latin text with which he was dealing was, in this respect, the proper rendering of syntax is not a refutation, because although verse 12 is not a finished comparison, nevertheless there is in it a subordinate comparison, or a coordinate comparison. And if the Pelagian view were correct, Paul could still have written verse 12 precisely as he did write it. Because in that instance, the comparison intimated in hutos, by hutos, the comparison intimated in the second part, beginning with kai hutos, would be a comparison between the entrance of sin and death and the passing on of sin and death. And that is what Pelagius maintained. But as sin and death entered through one man, so sin and death continue through the sins of all. The sin of all men. So neither grammar of Thantes Hemarton, nor the syntax of the passage refutes the Pelagian exegesis. You can't refute it on the basis of grammar or syntax. But nevertheless, there are factual, exegetical, and theological objections to this Pelagian exegesis. Can be refuted conclusively on the basis of factual, exegetical, and theological considerations. No refutation of that Arabian Jesus. Lowercase Romans 1, 2, 3, and 4. Lowercase Romans 1. It is not factually true. Not factually true. Not all die because they actually sin. Infants die, but they have not transgressed after the similitude of Adam's. That is to say, they have not personally and voluntarily transgressed a commandment of God. The reason being that they are not psychologically capable. They may die immediately after emergence from the mother's womb. They may die in the mother's womb. But they suffer death. You see, in verse 14, as we shall notice in a moment, Paul speaks of sinning after the similitude of Adam's transgression. Sinning after the similitude of Adam's transgression. The Pelagian exegesis is that all sin after the similitude of Adam's transgression. The dialectic, Barth and Brunner, the dialectic theology says the very same thing. Let all men sin after the similitude of Adam's transgression. But what about infants? So there is an insuperable objection from the standpoint of empirical fact. Now, second, there is now the exegetical. First exegetical argument. That in verses 13 and 14, Paul speaks the very opposite of the Pelagian exegesis. What does he say? Death reigned over those who did not sin after the similitude of Adam's transgression. Did not sin after the similitude of Adam's transgression. Now, it's not our concern now to determine the denotation. To determine the denotation of those who Paul had in view. That's not our interest. The question is the explicit statement that death reigned over certain persons who did not sin after the pattern of Adam's transgression. Now this bears directly upon the Pelagian exegesis. The Pelagian exegesis says the very opposite of what Paul says. And Paul says the very opposite of what the Pelagian exegesis says. Namely, that death reigned over certain persons who were in an entirely different category from that of Adam. Entirely different category. Described as who did not sin after the similitude of Adam's transgression. The third, the most conclusive refutation is again an exegetical one. Namely, that Paul says the very opposite of the Pelagian exegesis repeatedly in this passage. He says the very opposite repeatedly. He says that condemnation and death reigned over all men by reason of the one sin of the one man, Adam. The sins that all men commit than this expression, the one sin of the one man, Adam? Because that expression, the one sin of the one man, Adam, emphasizes as plainly as language can the singularity of the sin. Pelagian exegesis rests upon the untold plurality of sins. The sins of all, the actual sins of all men. And if Paul says that the ground of the condemnation and death of all is the one sin of the one man, Adam. If he says that, he could not have used language more plainly in refutation of the Pelagian exegesis. But that is exactly what Paul does. And he says it on 5 successive occasions in this passage. 5 times in the parenthesis from verses 15 to 5 times in the verses 15 through 19. Now remember that verses 15 through 17 part of the parenthesis that is intended to explicate for us what he had said in verse 12. And verses 18 and 19 are the recapitulation of what he would have said in verse 12 if he had closed the comparison. So you see how relevant are the statements in verses 15 through 19 to the precise question at issue. Now I have been dealing with this Pelagian view of the sin referred to in Epaphras Haematon, and I have come to the third criticism, namely that this Pelagian exegesis is in direct contradiction of the repeated affirmations of this passage. And at the close of the hour, I had come to this point that if Paul says that the reign of the condemnation and death proceeds from the one sin of the one man, Adam, then it is impossible at the same time to say that men have come into condemnation and die because of their own natural transgression. And that is precisely what Paul says repeatedly in this passage from verses 15 through 17 through 19. You have that principle repeatedly asserted by the trespass of the one. The many died, verse 15. The judgment was from one to condemnation, verse 16. By the trespass of the one, death reigned through the one. By the trespass of the one, death reigned through the one, verse 17. Through one trespass, judgment came upon all men unto condemnation. By verse 18, and then through the disobedience of the one man, the many were constituted sinners. Now do pay attention to these repeated affirmations, stated in different ways, but all leading to this all important proposition that death and condemnation came to reign over all men, over the whole human race, by the one sin, the one man, Adam. You might think that the Apostle Paul had quite needlessly repeated himself. He was guilty of redundancy. But it is just because the apostle was so jealous to establish that peace of the significance for the whole human race of the one sin, of the one man Adam, that he reiterated that principle in different forms so that it would be absolutely watertight and that the conclusion would be absolutely inescapable. And it is quite impossible to construe this reiterated emphasis upon the one sin of the one man, Adam, as equivalent to the actual personal sins of all men. Impossible to construe as the actual personal sins of all men. Because, may I say again what I mentioned yesterday, that the whole emphasis here is upon singularity. Whereas when you are thinking of the personal transgressions of all men, you have in mind plurality, uncountable plurality. Now for that this Pelagian construction is not compatible with the whole structure of this passage. It's not compatible with the governing principle of this whole passage, the structure. The central strand in this passage is the parallelism between the entrance of sin, condemnation, and death, and the entrance of righteousness, justification, and life. The parallelism between the way in which sin, condemnation, and death came to reign, and the way that righteousness, justification, and life come to be operative. And in view of that parallelism, there must be an identity of modus operandi in Latin phrase. There must be an identity, modus operandi. Otherwise, the analogy couldn't obtain. The parallelism couldn't obtain. Now, what is the parallel in reference to righteousness? What is that? It is simply this: justified by the righteousness of the one man, Jesus Christ. Nothing could be more obvious. Justified by the righteousness of the one man, Jesus Christ. And Paul is so insistent upon establishing the parallelism here. He calls the righteousness of Jesus Christ the one righteous act. The one righteous act. The one righteousness. And then in verse 19 he calls it the obedience of the one. So undoubtedly, It is the one righteousness of the one man, Jesus Christ. And what Paul is controverting, what he is controverting for what? It's the doctrine he's controverting. Now, that is what is true on the other side of the parallel. What is it that provides the parallel? In the case of Adam, what is it that provides it? Is it the actual sins of all men as the ground of condemnation? If it were the actual sins of all men, then that would be parallel to the very doctrine that the Apostle Paul is refuting. Parallel to the very doctrine he is refuting, namely, that men are justified by their own works. And so the only thesis that can provide the parallel to justification and life, the one sin of the one man, Adam, as the ground, the condemnation, only provide the analogy, the one sin of the one man, Adam, as the ground of condemnation. Oh, you see, you have actual exegetical and theological consideration militating against the Pelagian exegesis, and therefore militating against current. Well, so much for that. That's the refutation of the Pelagian. Now we come to the next interpretation of this passage of the last clause, and that is the Roman Catholic. Now there, it is to be admitted that there was not unanimity in the history of the Roman Catholic Church on this question. There were two very notable Roman Catholics at the time of the Reformation of Trent, maintained the position that I think is the correct. They were Catharinus and P.G.R.I.N.U.S. and P.G.I.U.S. Catholic. But nevertheless, the contentions of Catharinus and P. did not win the day in the Catholic Church. And although there is a good deal of obscurity on in the Catholic precinct, which I'm not going to enter now, nevertheless, classic Roman Catholic position, preponderant Roman Catholic position, that the Pantes Haemarton, 512b, the Pantes Haemarton refers to habitual or original sin transmitted to Adam's posterity by natural generation. Habitual or transmitted to Adam's posterity by natural generation. That, according to the Roman Catholic construction, consists mainly in the privation of sanctity. The privation of sanctity. Now the Roman Catholic Church recognizes that habitual sin, Adam, is privation of prevarication, as it is called, in eating the forbidden fruit. But nevertheless, the sin that is passed on to posterity is the habitual resulting from Adam's prevarication. Now this view will not hold up. There are accidents and theological objections to this Roman Catholic view also. The first that I mentioned is Comte's argument regarded as demonstrably presumptive, and I might call it a grammatical argument against it, is that it is very difficult reconcile this interpretation of the historical theorists, because this view refers to a certain condition which is perpetually from Adam, and although it is not absolutely impossible, not absolutely of the aorist tense, it would be quite abnormal. And what you would expect here, the perfect tense, rather than the aorist tense, exactly what Paul had in mind. Not that all sin, but that all have come to be sinful. And the perfect tense would be perfectly expressed that idea, but have come to be sinful, because it would denote a present condition resultant upon a past act. Admirably suited would not be, to say the very least, appropriate. However, there might be a way, which I don't want to discuss now, there might be a way for the argument, but it is not something just to be completely overlooked. Now the second argument against this Roman Catholic view is that it's quite contrary. Parallelism. Quite contrary to the connection with justification. The central strand, again, of this passage is the analogy between Adam and Christ. Now, what is Paul's doctrine with reference to justification? It's not that we are justified by having righteousness. We are not justified by being made subjectively holy through our relationship to Christ. We are justified by His once for all accomplished righteousness. Now, of course, the Roman Catholic Church is not inconsistent at this point, because the Roman Catholic Church does believe that justification consists and renovation, and so on. The Roman Catholic doctrine of justification, the parallel between Adam and Christ would hold. But the point now is that the Roman Catholic doctrine of justification is not Paul's doctrine. There isn't one syllable in this passage. Suggesting the Roman Catholic doctrine of justification. Everything in this passage points to our justification by the one righteousness, the one man, Jesus Christ. Justification by the one righteousness or obedience of the one man, Jesus Christ. And therefore, again, as in connection with the Pelagian exegesis, the only parallel to that is that we have become condemned, that we are condemned and the heirs of death. by the one sin of the one man, Adam. Now the third argument and refutation. The third argument and refutation is again the sustained emphasis of the passage in verses 15 through sustained emphasis of the passage that condemnation has passed upon all and that death comes to reign over all by the one sin of 15:16 by the trespass of the one the men died. Judgment was from one unto condemnation. By the disobedience of the one, the many were constituted. Remember the five distinct instances which that very same principle is asserted, and asserted in different forms in order to exclude all possibility of escape from the conclusion that it was by the one sin of the one man, Adam, that condemnation came passed upon all men and that death came to exercise its sway upon him. Now, habitual sin, original sin transmitted, can never be called the one sin of the one man. Never. Truly that is conclusive. Adam, by his fall, he involved himself in a big sin. He became sinful. He became depraved. But that depravity transmitted to posterity can never be called the one sin of the one man, Adam. And so you see the Roman Catholic interpretation really refuted. Now come to Calvin's interpretation, and Calvin's own interpretation. Exegetically speaking, Calvin's interpretation is identical with the Roman Catholic. Exegetically. His view of original sin is radically different. Rome construed original sin, habitual sin, as consisting very largely in the privation of sanctity. Whereas Calvin regarded original sin as radical depravity, as consisting not simply in the loss of original righteousness, but the corruption of man's whole nature. I repeat, consisting not simply in the loss of original righteousness, but corruption of his whole nature. And you must remember that a great deal of the polemic of the reformers on this question was directed against the Roman Catholic of original sin, habitual sin. The polemic of the Reformation, especially of Calvin and the Reformers, is to a very large extent focused on the refutation of the Roman Catholic doctrine. But nevertheless, exegetically speaking, Calvin's own interpretation of Romans 5:12b, et o pantis hemartum, is in the same category as the Romanist interpretation, b because he takes it as referring to original sin, to hereditary depravity. He calls hereditary depravity that in Adam all became sinful. And you'll find that in his commentary, of course, and you'll find it also in the Institute. You'll find it quite clearly stated in his commentary on Romans, but Paul distinctly affirms that sin is propagated to all who suffer its punishment, and this he afterwards more expressly declares when a little later he assigns the reason why all of Adam's posterity are subject to the dominion of death. Even this, he says, seeing that we all have sinned, but to sin is in this case to be corrupt and vitiated. See, he just quoted Romans 5:12b, and that all sin, inasmuch as all sin, corneum omnes peccavimus, but to sin is in this case to be corrupt and vitiated. For that natural depravity which we bring from our mother's womb, though it does not immediately bring forth its fruits, is nevertheless sin in the sight of God and deserves his vengeance. And this is the sin which they call original. For so Adam at his first creation received both for himself and for posterity the gifts of divine favor, so by falling away from the Lord, he in himself corrupted, vitiated, depraved, and ruined our nature. Having been divested of God's likeness, he could not have begotten seed but like himself. Therefore we all have sinned, because we have all been imbued with natural corruption, and so are become wicked and perverse. Now there's a total difference between Calvin's conception of this perversity that we all derive from Adam and the Roman Catholic conception of habitual sin, but you see, it is in the same category exegetically. Now, this had been an Augustinian tradition. The Roman Catholic Church followed that Augustinian tradition, but of course watered down the Augustinian conception of original sin. Calvin did not water down the Augustinian conception of original sin, but he did not get above or beyond the Augustinian tradition in the interpretation of this particular passage. And so the same arguments must be pleaded against Calvin's own interpretation of this passage as are pleaded against Roman Catholic. I don't need to repeat these, they all apply. I would not urge the first presumptive argument with the same vigor or with the same terms against Calvin's view as I would a Roman Catholic, because the way he puts it, you might possibly reconcile it with these tenses. By falling away from the Lord, that is Adam, by falling away from the Lord, he in himself corrupted, vitiated, depraved, and ruined our nature. Now, we have noted already, and I think we have proved on exegetical and theological grounds, that when Paul says in Romans 5:12, all sinned, And when in subsequent verses he emphasizes the one sin of the one man, Adam, he is referring to the same event. An event. The same historical fact. All sin, one man sin, is sin. And that would mean, of course, in theological terms, that all sin in Adam. So that is not expected what Paul says in Romans chapter 12. Yes, that is the meaning. And that is the form he uses into as in Adam all die, even though in Christ shall all be made alive. And the implication of 1 Corinthians that in Adam all sin, in Christ all will be constituted righteous. Now, what mode? By what mode does the sin of Adam become the sin of all? By what mode, by what method is the sin of Adam reckoned as the sin of all in the divine constitution? We haven't done anything so far to solve that question. We have proven the identification, but we haven't said anything as to the method, the modus operandi, by which the sin of Adam is the sin of all, or is reckoned as the sin of all, or becomes the sin of all. There are historically speaking two views, mediate imputation. Now the name associated with mediate imputation was in the 17th century. A professor in France, the theological school of Tom Moore, Joshua Plaquette, the French were having simply last time. Two scientists by that name in class. And he was active in France at the middle of the 17th century. Now he was understood that original sin consisted simply and solely in hereditary depravity. In the depravity that is conveyed by natural generation to all of Adam's descendants. That is the meaning. And consequently, the synod of the Reformed Churches in France, Charles, in December 1644 and January 1645, condemned that position, and propounded the doctrine that original sin consisted of two elements, inherited depravity and the implication of the first sin. That was all that the synod said at that particular time. Both elements must be. Now, of course, Plaquette, being Mr. of the replied to that decree of the synod, denied the implication. In fact, that he maintained the implication of that entirely with the synod, and propounding both elements as indispensable to Orthodox doctrine. But in this immediate and immediate imputation, what he professed to maintain was the mediate imputation of that. And the distinction between mediate imputation and immediate imputation was to this effect, that immediate imputation, that the sin of Adam immediately imputed because of the relation, and is therefore not mediated through hereditary depravity. Not mediated, mediated. That the first sin of Adam mediated through. So you see, in the order of nature, as he called it, in the order of nature, immediate imputation supposes that Adam's first sin seeds the corrupt involvement in Adam's first sin, corruption. Whereas in the latter case, involvement in Adam's sin through corruption follows upon, in a word, according to mediated imputation to posterity of Adam's first sin, mediated through the inheritance of corrupt nature, whereas on immediate, the corruption of nature that belongs to posterity is inherited by natural generation, is the consequence, involvement, inheritance of a corrupt nature which comes by natural inheritance of a corrupt nature. Very easy to understand why Lacaille was understood to deny the imputation of Adam's sin altogether. Subsequent to this sin, in the work in which he replies to the decision of subsequent to this, the very impression dealt. Know this, you, what we waited for, the thought on this. There were men on the continent of Europe where alleged the doctrine of several men on the continent of Europe, very dry and Calvinist, and these men who walked in the old days, very carefully weighed me most of the time. I am firmly convinced the history of this world has been greatly distorted. A great many of those who have been alleging, for example, that a man like Stapfer, European theologian, was an exponent of mediating. He didn't understand the staff that was getting. The same applies to Jonathan Edwards. It has been alleged that he taught mediating. I hope I am clearly proved in that book. But that is not the case. People have misunderstood Jonathan Edwards because they weren't able to follow him in the depth of his thought. And there the meeting walked me, he had recognized that. And did not fall to be very glad that he did that. He walked me, thought Charles Hodge, and even William Cunningham, thought that Jonathan Edwards did diverge from the on his work on original sin. That is not the case. Quite convinced that due to misunderstanding, the failure, the follow Jonathan Edwards, penetration of his thought. I think Jonathan Edwards was not dealing with the mode of imputation, but with the character of the sin that is imputed. And I'll come back to that later on. The analysis of the nature of the sin that was imputed still held to the immediate imputation. No ground for the allegation that Jonathan Edwards held to the immediate imputation. Now some of his successors, like Samuel Hopkins, did espouse something that is somewhat similar to, but nevertheless, went far beyond the doctrine of mediating, went far beyond the doctrine, hinges upon the doctrine of the imputation of Adam's sin altogether. Samuel Hopkins really couldn't be called a mediator, if you take historic sense. Starting point
founding of God meant ultimately the denial of the imputation of Adam's sin altogether. It applies to Nathaniel L. Emery, his wife, Nathaniel William Taylor. No, they're not in the same camp as they were on the classic, with all the classic doctrine of mediation. Now, Henry B. Smith, of course, you do have the spouse. It's historic sense. Well, therefore, Mr. Peter, point out to deal with the second group is in. No, this is it's not a question that's dictated that's directly German to exegesis, and particularly in the passages that are most relevant, Romans 5, 12 through 19, as well as relevant to what you might call biblical theological facts, but particularly the New Testament passage, inspired commentary on Genesis 3. Now you see the question is, why from this? Here is sin, condemnation, death. That's the rubric with which Paul is dealing in this passage. It's a parallel with righteousness, just all questions. Why has sin, condemnation, and death come to reign over the whole human race? Is there any question that's more practical? Why has sin, I repeat, condemnation and death come to reign over the whole human race? And the question now is precisely the relationship between the sin, the condemnation, and the death which reigns over posterity to the sinner. What is the relationship? Now, if mediate imputation is correct, mediate imputation is to this effect, that the reason why sin, condemnation have come to reign over the whole human race is that everyone by natural inherits a corrupt nature. Ultimately, going back to Adam, of course, as the original ancestor of all men, of all mankind, hereditary depravity, you have as far as posterity is concerned, that's what you must cost. Hereditary depravity and consequent condemnation. And inevitable destruction. You have to include hereditary depravity. Now that puts in focus the relevant biblical data, the exegetical data, we find that this construction of mediate imputation doesn't hold at all, but is expressly contradicted by the sustained emphasis of the text. It's expressly contradicted by the sustained emphasis. And that because dealing with human immediate imputation, lowercase Roman 1, will go in the opposite direction. This will start with death, because that's the order in which the apostle takes death, condemnation, sin. That's the order. He's more I could do it the other way, but I'll begin with death.